Hey, Marketplace listeners, you know, around here, we like to think you're never too young to learn about the economy and financial basics. That's why we're bringing the Million Bazillion Live Tour to school to teach important lessons about budgeting, investing, saving, and more. It's all the fun of the podcast, but now live, immersive, and interactive. Special thanks to our tour partner, Greenlight, the debit card and money app for kids and teens. Learn more about Greenlight at greenlight.com/million. That is greenlight.com/million.
Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California.
Healthcare.gov went to Capitol Hill today. Didn't go so well. Our man Mark Garrison went to Bankers Boot Camp. And we are going to go to Eastport, Maine today and tomorrow. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
Let Marketplace be your guide to the modern world. Subscribe to the Marketplace Tech Report podcast. Find it on iTunes or at marketplace.org/podcasts.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. This is the Marketplace podcast for Thursday, the 24th of October. Good to have you with us. The House Energy and Commerce Committee had itself a little hearing today. The deeply troubled launch of healthcare.gov, the Obamacare website, was the item on the agenda. So you knew going in there was going to be a fair amount of political posturing involved, some heated back and forth. But you probably didn't expect this, I'd bet, from New Jersey Democrat Frank Pallone.
So once again, here we have my Republican colleagues trying to scare everybody.
Will the gentleman yield?
No, I will not yield to this monkey court or whatever this thing
is. This is not a monkey court.
Do whatever you want. I'm not yielding.
I don't even know what that means, actually. But if you've ever been involved in a big project with lots of moving parts and lots of people, you know you got to have somebody in charge, somebody to make the decisions and keep everybody else in line. In the world of complex IT contracts, that person is called a lead systems integrator. Who was doing that for healthcare.gov, do you suppose? Seems like maybe nobody was. Marketplace's Amy Scott reports.
Think of a lead systems integrator as a general contractor on a house, managing the painters and plumbers and electricians. Only in this case, it was a very complicated house with some 55 contractors.
And it appears the notion was that we're going to do the contract integration in-house.
Paul Light is a professor of public service at New York University. By in-house, he means at the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services. Here's Republican Congresswoman Renee Elmers of North Carolina in today's hearing.
I am hearing repeatedly and repeatedly that the bottom line here is CMS is responsible for this failure.
There have been lots of questions about why the government didn't bring in some A-list integration firm to begin with. Stan Soloway says that used to happen. He represents government contractors at the Professional Services Council. Then came Deepwater in the early 2000s. The massive Coast Guard modernization program was initially overseen by private firms.
And it was not terribly successful, and a lot of people have pointed to the use of the lead systems integrator as the root cause of the problem.
But if the government wants that job?
First thing they're going to have to do is buy some more people.
Trevor Brown teaches public affairs at Ohio State.
They're going to need to recruit and retain systems engineers, program managers, integrators.
And Brown says competing for those talented folks has only gotten harder. Not only can they make a lot more in the private sector, they don't have to worry about shutdowns and furloughs. I'm Amy Scott for Marketplace.
White House spokesman Jay Carney resolutely refused to use the past tense today. He said, and this is a quote, "The United States is not and will not monitor German Chancellor Angela Merkel's cell phone." Nothing about did not monitor. And that statement did not assuage the ill will the Germans and Europeans are feeling about allegations the NSA eavesdropped all over the continent. Whether they are angry enough over there to do something about it, that's where Marketplace's Adrian Hill picks it up.
The U.S. ambassador to Germany has been summoned to do some explaining. It's unusual and a sign the Europeans are seething. French official Michel Barnier says there's a sense of betrayal.
Between friends, between allies, we need trust, we need confidence. And I think that this confidence has been shaken.
Okay, let's put aside the assumption that pretty much everybody is spying on everybody else. This is public. This is embarrassing. One of the questions for European leaders as they meet in Brussels today is just how far they can go in showing their displeasure when it's with a big deal ally and trade partner. One place they might put their collective European foot down is with the SWIFT program that allows Europe to share information with the U.S. about money transfers. German political commentator Heinz Schulte doubts it'll end, but...
I cannot rule out that there will be a temporary suspension to say, okay, suspend it for 4 weeks or what have you, to voice their anger clearly vis-a-vis the Americans.
The bigger question is whether the spying allegations threaten a multi-trillion-dollar trade deal currently in the works between the U.S. and the EU. Simon Tilford is with the Center for European Reform.
The Germans have invested a lot of political capital in this, and I very much doubt they would use this crisis to hamper those negotiations.
But they are likely to get trickier, especially around the already thorny issue of data and privacy. I'm Adrienne Hill for Marketplace.
All y'all who are counting on getting in on the Twitter IPO, first of all, good luck. Second of all, we now know how much it's going to cost you if you do get in. The company said in a filing today it's going to sell 70 million shares, 70 million shares, priced between $17 and $20 a share. It's going to raise almost $11 billion for the little company that could. On Wall Street today, three up arrows, details, numbers, when we get. A story now about a financial services company. It does credit cards and insurance and checking and savings accounts. But it only does them for a relatively small group of people, active duty military, veterans, and their families. And just like its clientele is different, so are the people who work there and what you might call their on-the-job training. Marketplace's Mark Garrison reports from San Antonio on the curious case of USAA.
It is 3 a.m, definitely not banker's hours. I've set multiple alarms to make sure I get up. I absolutely need to be on time because the guy I'm meeting at USAA does not tolerate tardiness.
Hey, Private, you better correct that right now. Get down and push.
That's Gil Lombana, an Army Reserve drill sergeant, and he's just warming up. There are buses full of bankers on the way. He and others in uniform are about to give them several hours of hell. As each bus rolls up, drill instructors bang on it. The USAA employees get off fast. They run through the early morning darkness to a field as smoke machines, strobe lights, and loudspeakers simulate combat. The drill instructors get right in their face.
You think I played with you?
It is not like this at Citibank. USAA bankers go through this so they can really know their customers. Among them, Jessica Allison, who works in real estate, not a field where she's likely to learn the name of the Navy's top officer.
Who is the CNO? All your shipmates are just screaming it.
The CNO is...
The answer doesn't come fast enough.
On the ground.
The drill instructor makes her do a push-up for each word of the correct answer twice. There are also waves of sit-ups and side-straddle hops, or what civilians call jumping jacks. Let's step away from boot camp for a bit and take a look inside headquarters.
Well, there's a photograph.
That's our time.
I run into Ron and Alice Fuller, both veterans and longtime USAA members. They're looking at artifacts on display for tourists. Yes, tourists. I'd never heard of anyone touring a bank or insurance headquarters, so I ask why.
We have a lot of confidence in them, and so we thought it would be just a neat idea to come by and see. And I'm very impressed. This is very, very impressive.
It may sound a little cultish to tour a bank building, but I kind of get it. Both my parents were in the military, so I'm a member, and I've seen people get emotional about the company. Often, when I swipe my USAA credit card, people see the Rippled Eagle logo and they want to talk about how happy they are to be members. That just doesn't happen with my Discover card.
Hi, this is Marissa with USAA. How may I assist you today?
Part of what members love about USAA is the customer service. Year after year, folks in this call center put them at or near the top of various client satisfaction rankings. Customer experience consultant Bruce Temkin says a key to USAA's success is its singular focus on the military.
you serve just one type of customer, it's easy to understand their needs and to serve them better.
That helped USAA thrive, even in the downturn. But now it's got a problem. Big banks are attacking its turf. Morningstar analyst Jim Sinegal says mega banks want military clients who are stable and profitable.
Military jobs are typically long-term, very secure, very little risk of a person going out and losing that job. It's steady pay. It's generally directly deposited.
USAA is odd in the financial world, basically an insurance company that got into banking 30 years ago. The bank is relatively young and tiny compared to America's financial giants. They are now stealing pages from USAA's playbook, crowing about hiring veterans and offering military deals. USAA faces a tough battle, and it's scaling up and fighting back.
USAA Bank proudly serves current and former military members and their families.
It recently launched national advertising after doing practically none in its history. Their marketing is puny compared to banking's giants. But when it comes to understanding the military customer, Bank President David Boney says other banks will never match USAA.
From a pride standpoint, we think we do it better than anybody and that we want to make sure that the competitors don't get a foothold in this group.
Which brings us back to boot camp, which ends in a run. I jog alongside Jessica Allison.
I'm hanging in there.
I got called out for messing up their line, so trying not to get anybody in trouble. I'm going to keep to the sidelines.
Drill instructors applaud the sweaty bankers as they finish. I'm curious if the info she suffered for stuck. So who is the chief of naval operations again?
Admiral Jonathan Greenert.
Correct. Armed with new knowledge of the stress of military life, Allison says she's now better able to serve clients. That's vital to USAA's future, defending its military territory by knowing it best. In San Antonio, I'm Mark Garrison for Marketplace.
Michelle Stevenson and her husband Joe Brewster have spent the past 14 years making a documentary film. They didn't have to go far to do it. They followed their son Idris around for 14 years while he was a student at the Dalton School in New York City, an African-American student at the mostly white Dalton School, it should be said. The movie is called American Promise. It's good to have you both in the studio.
Thank you for having us.
Thank you.
Is this, I've been trying to figure out ever since I watched this film, is this a story, and I'll let you guys figure out who wants to answer it, is it a story of race or is it a story of class and culture?
Well, the answer is E, all of the above.
I think I only gave you two. I think C would have been all of the above. But anyway.
We don't see how you separate the two.
Mm-hmm.
Right. I mean, and the two are inextricably linked. I mean, there were assumptions about what his background was because of his race.
Yeah.
Where we thought we were avoiding the racial achievement gap in education for boys, we found ourselves in the midst of it and in the midst of a struggle to have our son and ourselves to a certain extent understood in all our complexities.
And he is amazingly aware of it, even at a really young age. I want to play a piece of tape from this film. We're going to let it run a little bit, where he talks about and asks you, I guess, Joe, whether he would have been better off being white. Let's hit that one.
I don't know. But if I was white, then I'd be better off. Isn't that true?
You asking me?
Yes.
What do you think?
Yes. Well, at this school, I'm not saying I want to, but wouldn't that be, isn't that right? That's what everyone else is saying.
That would have killed me if my kid had come home and told me that. Michelle, what do you, I mean?
Yeah, I mean, what's obviously going on in that situation and what we are learning in the process through the use of the camera is he's having conversations with his peers, trying to figure out, you know, not only how they fit in, but how can they fit in and what are the things around them that are painful for them that they can't change.
You two are not forgiving parents. Your expectations are clearly extremely high for your child, for your children. How much of that, Joe, is because your children are African-American males? Do they have to be better to compete in this society?
Well, they don't have to be better, but we don't feel that they're going to compete on an unlevel playing field without being a little bit better, without being aware of the fact that the playing field is tilted to their disadvantage.
You put Idris in Dalton, in theory, so he can get into good schools. And he does not have a great success rate in getting into the Berkeleys and the Stanfords and the Harvards and all this. If he had said at that moment when you guys were sitting in front of the laptop reading all those rejection letters, if he had said, Mom, you know, screw it. I don't want to go to school. I don't want to go to college. How would that have gone over? Yeah, you're this is one of those where we needed a video camera on you right there.
Well,
that's not possible.
Yeah, I don't think you would have made it possible. That's pretty clear in this movie.
I mean, we would have had some intense conversations.
Yeah. You guys had a lot of intense conversations.
Yeah,
I mean, it was a little bit draining actually to watch this film. It's hard because the choices he has to make and you guys are making are hard and the circumstances are hard.
This is a film. It's something that is just a slice of all of our lives. It's a slice that we chose to put together to make certain points, but also to touch, hopefully, at some common core humanity that we all share, while trying to shed light on the types of perceptions that our boys face, but also to try to provide greater complexity on what it means just to educate children, period.
The film is called American Promise by Michelle Stevenson and Joe Brewster. They are filmmakers and parents. It's a good film. Check it out. Thanks, you guys, for coming in.
Thank you for having us.
Thank you very much.
Coming up.
A lot of people who come to see the mill think they've come into Willy Wonka's chocolate factory. Lots of things going around and around and up and down.
Not chocolate, it's mustard in down east Maine. But first, let's do the numbers. The Dow Industrial's up 95 points today, 0.6%, finished at 15,509. The NASDAQ added 21 points, 0.5%, 39.28. The S&P 500 added 5 points, 0.3%, ended things at 1752. Ford Motor Company shifted up 1.3% today on record earnings. Overseas demand grew last quarter, and Ford is once again talking about profitability in Europe. Dow Chemical peeled off 1%. Epoxy sales are down. What is doing well for the company? One word, plastics. Symantec erased nearly 13%. Today, the maker of Norton Antivirus just can't find as many Windows-based PCs to protect these days, it seems. Bond prices fell. The yield on the 10-year T-note nudged up to 2.51%, and you are listening to Marketplace.
Do you enjoy the music we play between stories? Visit the Marketplace music section to browse playlists for all of our programs and to buy those songs on Amazon. A percentage of each purchase goes towards supporting our programs. Find more online at marketplace.org/music.
From the Marketplace Datebook, here's a look at what's coming up Friday. The Commerce Department is scheduled to report on durable goods orders for September. Maybe you invested in a new durable good, like a standing mixer. UPS hopes you had it shipped. The company releases quarterly earnings. And while we're in the kitchen with our new mixer, let's make angel food cake. October is National Bake and Decorate Month. Cool it, frost it, bedazzle it. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace from APM. I'm Kai Rizdal. Four facts now about the magazine TV Guide. One, it still exists. Two, it's been profitable for the past 3 years. Three, its parent company just announced major plans to grow its publishing arm. And four, circulation is down by a third, and that's why the magazine is succeeding. Marketplace's Dan Weissman has the story.
Opengate Capital bought TV Guide in 2008 for $1. The private equity firm became the magazine's fifth owner in just 10 years. Circulation was down from a peak of 20 million to like 3. Also, the deal did not include the website TVGuide.com or the TV Guide TV channel, but Opengate founder Andrew Niku and his partners specialize in turnarounds. They like the idea.
You're not going to find many opportunities where you have a brand of this stature.
Especially not for a buck, which still didn't make it a sure thing. The owners approached a magazine veteran about heading TV Guide. Jack Klieger had run magazines like Elle and GQ. He said maybe.
I have to first take a look and see if it's all dead or mostly dead.
Cable had made TV Guide's original model, listings, impractical. There were too many channels to list. Kleeger's plan focused on the guide part of the magazine's title. With a million channels, what's worth watching?
Quite frankly, how much TV can one watch a week? After 20 hours, you become a zombie.
So, reviews, not listings. He also set out to cut the circulation even more to the 2 million most loyal readers. That saved on paper, printing, and shipping. Now, revenue's down by almost half, but TV Guide makes money. Bill Mickey is editor of Folio, a magazine for and about the magazine industry. I asked him, so if I told you 5 years ago that TV Guide was going to be profitable, looking to grow in 2013, what would you say?
No way.
Who knows? Maybe Newsweek will come back. I'm Dan Weissman for Marketplace.
Solar installations in this country jumped 15% last quarter. Seems leasing programs for rooftop solar panels are pretty popular. More solar is good for the environment and energy security. Not so good, though, for traditional utilities, because at some point, enough solar panels feeding the power grid from enough rooftops will start to undermine utilities' business models. In California, there's a deal to keep the peace on that score, for now anyway. Marjorie Sun reports.
At the private San Rafael Airport in Marin County, take a peek inside one of the 100 hangars here, and you'll find airplanes, of course, and some surprises. Bob Herbst is the airport's manager.
My father-in-law's got some of his car collection in here, and then his fishing boat that he takes out salmon fishing in San Francisco.
And on top of the hangars is another surprise, 4,600 solar panels. The airport uses some of the solar power for itself. It sells most of it to a new community power company, 1 megawatt's worth.
Yeah, so that's enough to power about 1,200 Marin homes on a typical summer afternoon when they're all running their air conditioning.
That megawatt earned the airport $250,000 last year from the new utility, MCE Clean Energy. It was created by local governments to provide more electricity from renewable sources. It's captured about 80% of Marin County's customer base from PG&E. So in this small corner of its territory, PG&E is one of the first big utilities to confront the solar industry's challenge to its business model.
So this is really an ongoing question and probably the most controversial issue of all right now in the U.S. solar industry.
Michelle DeCapua is head of North American analysis at Bloomberg New Energy Finance. Solar installations don't just cut into the electricity sold by a big utility. They use its grid and depend on its generating plants for backup power. Non-solar customers usually carry the brunt of these costs. California has already cut the link between electricity use and profit. If more PG&E customers install solar panels, the utility can ask for a rate hike to make up for that lost revenue. PG&E spokesman Denny Boyles.
Our profit isn't tied to the amount of electricity that we sell.
But PG&E still has to maintain backup power and the grid for solar customers. To share this expense more evenly, this month California passed a law that allows utilities to bill solar customers an extra $10 a month to support those fixed costs. The solar industry got a win, too. The law removes a limit on the amount of electricity solar customers can sell to a utility. DeCapua from Bloomberg calls the new law.
We're calling AB 327, we call it the Great Solar Compromise.
But DeCapua predicts cloudy days ahead for most other states where the revenue of traditional utilities is directly tied to electricity use. The growth of solar power in the U.S., he says, is...
But again, the growth is really tremendous.
And this year...
It's a massive market. And for the first time in history, the U.S. solar industry will see more installations than the U.S. wind industry.
And by the end of 2020, he says, solar power could sap 3% or more of utility sales in states including New Jersey, Massachusetts, and Arizona. That might not sound like much, but it's a big deal in this industry, which is growing less than 1% a year. I'm Marjorie Sun for Marketplace.
Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California's Marshall School of Business.
This final note on the way out today, a sneak peek of sorts at tomorrow's broadcast. Eastport, Maine is where we're going to be, the next stop in our series American Futures with Jim Fallows and The Atlantic. So right now, a taste of down east Maine. Quite literally, we're talking about mustard here, people.
Ray's mustard, authentic 100% stone ground quality. Oh, it does smell like mustards.
Oh, wow.
Man.
Hi, how are
I'm
you?
Karen Ray.
Hi, Karen. Kai Risdahl. Nice to meet you.
Are you
Karen Ray of the Ray's Mustard?
I am.
Is that a mustard mill back there?
It is. Yeah. This is my husband, Kevin.
Hi, Kevin.
Hi there. How are you?
I got to go check this out.
Just stay clear of the machinery.
And when you say machinery, by the way, this is all like belts and pulleys and...
Yes. A lot of people who come to see the mill think they've come into Willy Wonka's chocolate factory. Lots of things going around and around and up and down. And it was designed and engineered and built by my great-great uncle, J. Wesley Ray. And in 1903, he designed and built this new mill.
Tell me about these stones and what they're doing.
Well, these stones are very rare. They're made of quartz. And the top stone, as you can see, spins. The bottom stone is stationary. And the mustard is pumped down through a hole in the top stone, you can see there. And it's essentially a scissor action. Maybe you've heard the expression, can you cut the mustard? That's what we're doing. We're cutting the mustard. This is where the finished product comes off.
Oh, look at that. That's like oozing mustard.
The reason there's a mustard mill here in Eastport, Maine, is that when J. Wesley was a young man, Eastport was the sardine capital of America. There were as many as 27 sardine canneries here on this little island. And mustard was a favorite medium in which to pack sardines.
Wow.
Because it enhanced the flavor of the fish, and it also has preservative qualities. However, the sardine industry is gone. And so now we have outlived all of our initial customers.
So if you couldn't have any of your own mustards, what would be your favorite other mustards?
Oh, I'd probably eat ketchup.
That was Jim, by the way. Jim Fallows asking the other mustard question. This is one of those radio stories that gets better with video. Check out what Ray's Mustard Mill looks like at our website. It's marketplace.org. And with that, we're done. That's Marketplace from APM. John Buckley, John Haas, Patty Hirsch, George Judson, Jonathan Karp, Ethan Lindsay, Dave Shaw, Betsy Streisand, and Celeste Wesson are the Marketplace editing staff. The managing editor is Sarah Gilbert. I'm Kai Risdahl. We will see you back here tomorrow, everybody. This is APM.
Hey there, I'm Bridget, co-host of Million Bazillion, Marketplace's podcast for kids about money. I want to tell you about our email newsletter course, Million Bazillion Academy. In this new and improved course, we'll help your kids learn about crypto, credit cards, and inflation in just 6 weeks. Each lesson comes with a podcast episode, a fun cartoon, discussion questions, and an activity that lets kids apply what they're learning in the real world. You can start at any time and work at your own pace. Sign up today at marketplace.org/academy.